Well, I think today, given the negligent start, we'll skip having a series of, an extended discussion of leftovers from the last lecture, especially since I didn't quite finish the last lecture. Let me begin. Does everybody have their outline from the last time? Because I didn't quite finish what we were exploring. Let me just finish our vocabulary lesson. I'll do it in a pretty efficient way. And then we'll turn to this extremely interesting, and I think a pretty deep question of what does it mean to say that the state is a capitalist state? To talk about the form of something constraining a content is essentially what that is about. Okay, but let's just wrap up our vocabulary lesson. We were on the topic of political power, where I discussed the idea of power in general as the capacity to produce transformations in the world, to generate effects. That's what it means to have a lot of power, is you can produce a lot of effects. It's a capacity to do things. I distinguished between instrumental and structural power. Instrumental power is the power that is wielded. Agents use it. So when you talk about instrumental power, you're talking about the actual capacity of people consciously to accomplish things they want to accomplish. Structural power are things which enable people to accomplish things, but it occurs in a sense behind their backs. It occurs as a result of the unintended consequences of practices rather than as the deliberate use of power. So we can say that the capitalist class has a great deal of structural power that comes simply from their mundane acts of investment and disinvestment. One can also talk about the structural power of the working class. I didn't mention that. I had a colleague in graduate school, Luca Perrone. He was my closest collaborator and friend. Indeed, the whole class structure project, which I then did, was initially generated as a way for us to continue working together. He went back to Italy, and we figured if we created this international comparative project, we'd be able to see each other. So the project was as much a vehicle for our continuing collaboration as it was simply because it was an intellectual agenda. Luca tragically died in a skin diving accident in 1982, so he was very important to me early on in my career. Well, he wrote a paper which had the following idea, which there hasn't been subsequent work on. It's a really cool idea, might tantalize some of you. And the idea was this. If you look at an economy and you do an input-output matrix of the economy by sector, so you have 100 sectors and you see how the output of every sector is an input to other sectors, you can identify sectors in the economy which have structural importance, because if they're disrupted, it has huge ripple effects, downstream ripple effects, right? And he said that workers in those sectors had structural power, because if they went on a strike against their employers, they disrupted the rest of the economy, even though that wasn't their purpose. So that's structural power, just like a capitalist engaging in disinvestment. And he made the prediction that there would be wage differentials between workers with structural power, defined in this way, that can't be explained by experience, education, human capital, or any of the other things that explain wages, that you'd find a wage differential that comes simply from their structural position in the economy as a whole. And it was true. He was able to demonstrate that. That's a pretty kind of cool finding, right? As far as I know, that particular idea hasn't been followed up in the literature. So that's structural power of labor. There is structural power of labor, but the structural power of capital, of course, looms very large in lots of discussions. The means and the efficacy of instruments of power, well, the forces of production and economic practices are clear. We can say you have highly productive and less productive forces of production. We can talk about them developing. So you can talk about forces of production that are very powerful, so to speak, with respect to the transformation of nature, and those which are less powerful. You can also talk about the extent to which individuals monopolize or don't monopolize these powerful forces of production. So you could have very powerful forces of production that were still collectively and democratically run. They weren't monopolized by small groups, so they didn't give concentrated power to particular agents. The power that comes with those forces of production could be controlled in common by large numbers of people or not. And the same sorts of things can be said about the means of production of politics. Well, what are the means of production of politics? I think that's where we ended. 2.3, as I recall.
Yeah.
Organizations are the key means of production of politics. Political parties and the state are the prime examples, but there are plenty of other organizations we could cite. Social movements have organizations. The labor movement is an organization that is a means of production of politics in politics. Organizations are central to political power because of their role in mobilizing collective action and constraining choice. And that's, after all, what political power is all about. Political power is power used to produce and transform social relations, and collective action is crucial for that. Okay, I'm whizzing through this because I want to get to the substantive stuff. As I think you can tell, I have a certain pleasure in carefully going through these concepts and showing how they fit together. I find it an aesthetic activity as much as a strictly intellectual one. But I have to discipline myself so that we don't short-circuit the more important issue, the payoff for this in understanding actually how the state works. Okay, let's shift from power to domination. Power and domination as context. Now, many uses of the term power essentially conflate it with domination. Power is equated with domination. If there's no domination, there's no power. I think it's better to think of it this way, that power is the capacity to when we're talking about political power, power is the capacity to transform relations. And this is distinct from domination, which is defined by situations in which there's unequal distributions of power defined in this way. Even in a utopian, communist, egalitarian society, there would be politics and power because there is a capacity to transform transform relations. It's one of the things you do if you're in a community and are collectively deliberating and problem solving. You have to transform relations. You just don't accept relations once and for all as being fixed and then just let them continue forever. And even if you did that, you'd have to be in the constant activity of reproducing those relations, since nothing continues just by inertia. So even if you have an egalitarian and profoundly democratic and participatory society, you still have to exercise power, but you wouldn't have domination. Domination then is a way of describing the distribution of power. Domination exists within a relation when one group or individual asymmetrically has power over other groups or individuals. At least that's the way I'm using the term. Sometimes power is used in that way too. So you'll find in the discussions of these issues that this is not a clear line of demarcation conceptually. I like to talk about the three faces of domination. The more standard language is the three faces of power. Stephen Lukes, a political sociologist and political theorist, philosopher really, wrote a very influential book called Power: Radical View, in which there's a second edition, which has some interesting things in it. This is a book that everybody should read. You know, it's part of your education as a sociologist, you should have as part of your menu. You know, one of the things that you've really understood is Stephen Lukes' Power: Radical View. It's a fairly old book now, originally published in 1974, but I think it's still actively read. I don't know if it's being assigned in political sociology here, but it should be. He discusses what he calls three faces of power, which I would call three faces of domination. These are all based on the kind of little model which talks about power over. A has power over B. Well, what does that mean? The first the first face of power is A dominate, and I'll use the word dominates here, okay? Because I'm talking about an asymmetry. A dominates B when A can get B to do something over the objections of B. That's what we could call instrumental power. That's the form of power that Weber emphasized. You have instrumental power over A, that is, you dominate A in this first sense. If you can get dominate B in this little formula, if you can get B to do something even over the objections of B. The second face of power is A dominates B when A can define the rays of alternatives open to B, within which B can freely choose what to do. So I dominate you if I have the capacity to set the parameters in which the choices, which determine the choices you face, the feasible set, and then just let you do whatever you want. But if I set those in such a way as to serve my interests, I've then guaranteed that whatever you do, it's fine with me. This is sometimes called agenda setting power. Sometimes this is called negative power, you know, the power to exclude options from your possibility set. Sometimes it's also called non-decision-making power. There's a very, this idea was originally introduced by two political scientists, I think in the late 60s, might have been early 70s, Bachrach and Baratz, where they were looking at different cities and why certain kinds of decisions got made, were on the table. It explains why in a city council you're debating certain options and not others. So the processes which exclude options are themselves processes of power. And the third form of power says A dominates B when A is able to realize A's interest at the expense of B's interest, even if B fully cooperates with A. This is different just from the agenda setting because it has more to do with the with the creation of dispositions and preferences. So if you have a well-functioning capitalist economy in which it's just taken for granted by people that the way to satisfy the interests of workers is to have a vibrant investment climate where business gets to invest and create jobs, and jobs creation by businesses is the crucial thing in order for workers to realize their well-being, that functioning of the economy aligns the interests of workers and capitalists. It means that capitalists are able to realize their interests at the expense of workers' interests, not just by excluding what's on the agenda of choice, but by defining the very interests that actors have within the existing game. It's essentially what game are you playing? The agenda setting is kind of about the rules of the game, and the instrumental power is basically about the moves in the game, to use that metaphor which we've discussed before. All right, I'm going to skip down to the state. How do we define the state? Domination is not just a problem of interpersonal relations as expressed in the metaphor of A getting B to act in particular ways. Domination is also inscribed in social institutions. This is crucial because it's the institutionalization of domination that makes it stable, as opposed to it just being a matter of the negotiations and relationships between persons. We can then define the state with respect to the distribution of power in a system of domination. And the way I would define it is with these three criteria. The state is the most superordinate, territorially centralized institution of domination in a society. So political power is unequally distributed within many arenas of social life. It's unequally distributed in the family, in the factory, in the classroom, in communities. each of these may be sites of domination or not. You know, you can have families in which are not sites of domination. I suppose one would think of domination of children, although a friend of mine always accused our household as being a pediocracy, you know, ruled by the children. He didn't have kids, and he was convinced that they clearly were in command and we were their servants. Nevertheless, domination exists in all sorts of sites. To the extent that these specific sites of domination in a given territory are themselves dominated by a central apparatus, so that there's domination of subordinate sites of domination, and you can think of that as meaning that the superordinate site sets the rules under which the subordinate sites function. So to the extent, for example, that the rules of domination within the family are set by laws, conventions, and so on imposed by the state, that the rules of the game of the family domination process are set by constitutional rules about and laws about privacy, the boundary between public and private responsibilities, the authority of men, the rights of women, the rights of children, all these things are set at this superordinate level. To the extent that's true, that is, that there is that hierarchy, then that centralized apparatus can be called a state. I like very much Joran Terborn, who we read for today's discussion. He has a very nice way of describing this superordinacy, what it means to have a superordinate institution of this sort. He describes it as the supreme institution of rule-making, rule-applying, rule-adjudicating, rule-enforcing, and rule-defending. That's a nice long sentence, you know, string of words, but the common word in all of them is rules, and that's really the way to think about it. And that fits in with our, what game are we playing, what are the rules of the game, what are the moves of the game. What the state is responsible for is setting up the rules. And that's the sense in which you have a different kind of state if you're enforcing the rules of one kind of game versus another kind of game. That's what we'll be discussing today, whether that renders the state fundamentally a different kind of state, depending upon what game it's specifying the rules for. It's a rule-making, applying, adjudicating, enforcing, and defending machine. That's superordinate, and superordinate means that it is itself not subjected to any higher level of rule-making, rule-applying, rule-adjudicating, rule-enforcing, and rule-defending. Now, one implication of this is that you can talk about the degree to which a territorially centralized apparatus is a state. There'll be variability in the stateness of a state because there's variability in the extent to which it can do all those sorts of things. State shouldn't be thought of as just a kind of simple binary. You either have a state or you don't have a state. No, you can have a state that not only has greater or lesser power, the state capacity, but is also to a greater or lesser extent fully satisfies the condition of being the superordinate, rule-making, rule-enforcing, etc. In the current world where there are emerging tendencies for there being some kinds of apparatuses that seem to be above the national state, that does some of the work of rule making, rule applying, rule adjudicating, etc. The World Trade Organization, for example, seems to do some of that stuff. There begins to be an ambiguity as to whether or not the national state is the most superordinate, or whether it's really its stateness has been eroded a bit by having a superordinate structure above it. Yeah.
So with the example of the WTO and a nation state, is there a distinction between the scope of power? So the WTO has a limited scope.
Right. So that's why it doesn't seem like a full-blown superordinate state, because it has a fairly narrow jurisdictional scope. Although because of the ambiguities as to, you know, what defines a relevant rule for trade, some of that scope begins to bleed out into other things. So environmental protection isn't typically a trade issue, but if you have rules in place in a country defended on the grounds of protecting the environment, but which might impede trade, then the WTO can take on adjudication. And if it gets away with it, then it makes the rules, right? So there's ambiguities around human rights, around all sorts of things that kind of interface with production, with the economy, even though they're not strictly about trade. And that's one of the contested things. It's one of the objections on the left for the TPP, for example, was the extent to which there'd be a rule-making capacity that would be superordinate to the state and not subordinated to any democratic process. So this just creates ambiguity. That's my only point here. This way of defining the state is a bit different from typical Weberian and at least some Marxist definitions of the state. So Weber's definition, famous definition of the state, was that the state is a territorially centralized apparatus which monopolizes the legitimate use of force over a territory. So he emphasizes the state's control over coercion on a territory as being the pivotal thing that defines that kind of organization as a state. Whereas in my definition, I didn't mention force per se. And in my elaboration using Terborn's formula, he also doesn't talk about force. He says rule enforcing, which, and forcing has a force-ish term in it, but it's not monopolizing the legitimate use of force that is at the centerpiece. It's making rules that are binding on people and seeing that they're enforced. That's what matters. And there's all sorts of ways of enforcing rules and certainly making them binding that fall short of using physical coercion. So physical coercion becomes one of the mechanisms of enforcing rules, but there's no reason to privilege it as the pivotal one. And by privileging it, it makes situations where the state doesn't really monopolize the use of force. And in a strict sense, in the United States, where we have state-created rules which allow people to have use the legitimate use of force as private citizens, you know, that's kind of weird. We have stand-your-ground laws now in a lot of states where you're allowed to shoot somebody on because they get on your, you know, your property and they won't leave, even if you don't have to prove that you're under personal threat. So the stand your ground laws, that sounds like it's that individual citizens have the legitimate use of force, not the states. Now, to be sure, the state has authorized that. We have a law that says stand your ground law. But is what the state done when it passes that law made citizens part of the state? It's just ambiguous. So, whereas if you just say that it's the rulemaking and rule enforcing aspect that matters, then it's clear. It's the state that's responsible for that rule and which created it and enforces it. And then this particular rule just allows for something other than the monopoly of the use of force. But that doesn't make it less of a state. So that's why I prefer Terborn's definition and then the particular way that I framed it over Weber's. Territory is still important. That's what states are about. Superordinacy, it's a supreme rulemaking. But the use of force is just one piece of it. It's not the centerpiece of it. It's also a little bit at odds with at least some Marxian accounts because nothing in my definition states that the state are apparatuses of class domination, just political domination. It's a discovery rather than a definition that states are also apparatuses of enforcing rules that reproduce class domination. That's not part of the definition of what renders a state. It's a discovery of a particular property of states in particular historical circumstances that they do that. They're also apparatuses for the enforcement of racial domination and ethno-nationalist domination and other forms of domination depending upon historical circumstances. Now, in the development of the theory of the state, rather than the concept of the state, in the development of the theory of the state, I will emphasize how central and important is the class character of the state. That's part of the theoretical argument, but it's not, I think, and it should not be part of the very definition of what renders a state a state. One of the implications of this is, I think, this helps to clarify a certain kind of what I think of as ultimately a sloppy formulation when in the classical Marxian utopian vision, when Marx talks about the withering away of the state, what he's really talking about is the withering away of class domination and the state's form as being a state of class domination. But he's not talking about, at least if it's meant to be anything like a perspective on what kind of world we might strive to achieve, it's not talking about the disappearance of a state, that is, of a superordinate institution that makes rules and enforces them. And thus a superordinate institution that actually has capacities of domination. The question about the character of that state then becomes of how deeply democratically subordinated can be the use of that state power. Is it a state power that's subordinated to a democratic egalitarian process of rulemaking, but which nevertheless does impose rules on everybody? And thus it is still an apparatus of domination, not of interpersonal domination, but of institutional domination. All right, I think let's skip the rest. I don't think we'll be getting into the state and civil society in other contexts. I think it's more important now to launch into what makes the state a capitalist state. Is there a spare copy of the outline floating around? I seem to not have kept one here for me, just so I can track where we are. So, well, let me just check. Does anybody have any loose ends from the vocabulary lesson that they'd like to just ask for further clarification of? All right, let's forge ahead. But now it's open game to interrupt me and ask for a clarification. You know, don't let me just ramble on without pause if you have issues you'd like to raise.
I'm sorry, Eric.
Yeah.
The subordination of the state to democratic processes directly affects the class character of the state.
Right, right, absolutely. Yeah, so so long as the state is a capitalist state, that curtails its democratic potential. It's impossible to have a radically democratic state and a capitalist economy. They're inconsistent. You can have a pretty democratic state in tension with an ongoing capitalist economy. That's possible. But you can't have a radically democratic state along with capitalism. Because a radically democratic state would necessarily violate the boundary between public and private. That's essential for the reproduction of private ownership of the means of production. That boundary could not be stable under radically democratic conditions. Is a hypothesis. I mean, that's not definitionally true, but I think it's a prediction about the world, that if we fully democratized the process by which social choices were made and the future is brought into the present through our deliberation, the boundary that protects private ownership of the means of production would have to be violated in such pervasive ways that while you could still have markets and you could have a limited role for capitalism in an economy, you could not have an economy in which capitalism was the dominant form of economic relations. democratizing the state would mean democratizing capitalism, but democratizing capitalism is an oxymoron because capitalism depends upon a set of property rights which give power to particular people, not to collectivities. That's going to be one of the central themes of our weekend retreat, you know, at the end of the semester when we are off in the woods, hopefully on a pleasant spring evening, debating the meaning of socialism. Yeah.
So is it inconsistent to say that if one were to radically democratize means of production, does that also mean that you cannot have private property of individuals or families?
No. It's private property in the means of production that we're talking about, not private ownership.
But so they're mutually exclusive to some extent.
It's just talking about you can't have the form of private property that gives you control over other people's lives. That's the kind of private property you can't have.
Right, so we're not saying we're excluding all types of private property, no. Only in the sphere of production.
Yeah, okay. No. I prefer to use the term personal property to describe all the things of your daily life that, you know, people own. So, sure, there'll be some people who in such circumstances might join forces and form communes, as it were, where you have collective property even for housing and frying pans, but there's no intrinsic reason why the socialization of means of production in the sense of democratization of the means of production implies a socialization of personal consumption and personal accoutrements of life. Yeah. Yeah, the term private and private property is ambiguous with respect to that. We use the term to mean anything that's owned by people. And the substantive idea here is those things you own which give you control over the lives of others. And the main form of that, you know, we could probably think of some other examples that isn't about production, but the main form of that centers around means of production, organizing economic activities. All right, so here's the pivotal issue in play. We observe in a capitalist economy that the state engages in a set of policies which are broadly supportive of capitalism. This doesn't mean the state can't make terrible mistakes in ways that cause great harm for capitalism. Of course, that can happen. But as a first cut into the analysis of what do states do in a capitalist society, they serve the interests of capitalists in the sense of creating and reproducing the conditions for capital accumulation. But how should we interpret this? What's the core explanation for the fact that the state broadly functions to serve the interests of the capitalist class and reproduce capitalism? There are two different approaches to this, two different ways that this has been thought about. One is referred to as instrumentalist approaches to the state, and the other as structuralist approaches. This also came to be known as the debate between the view that the state is a state in a capitalist society versus the state is a capitalist state. Instrumentalist approaches say that the state is itself institutionally neutral. It's just a machine that's sitting there, so to speak, but it's manipulated by powerful actors. The state is a state in capitalist society because powerful actors are capable of using it for their purposes. Using it means they treat the state as an instrument. The political task then is to seize this apparatus and wield it for other purposes. You know, if it's a neutral apparatus and it's powerful actors, well, those powerful actors need to be defeated. One way of defeating them is through electoral competition. Another way is through armed revolution. Depends upon the historical situation, the argument would go. But once you've seized state power, that's the classic expression, all you have to do is wield this apparatus for your purposes. The structuralist view says, no, that's not adequate. The very form of this state explains why it serves the interests of the capitalist class. It's a distinctively capitalist type of state. You can't just seize it. If you seize it and try to use it for working class purposes, for purposes of social emancipation, your goals will be undermined by the nature of the apparatus you're using. You will be constantly thwarted in your efforts to realize these ambitious emancipatory goals if you simply try to take the existing state with its bureaucratic machinery, with its particular ways of acquiring resources, with its particular ways of organizing democratic processes. If you try to use this, it will be self-defeating. What this means is that if you happen to be able to gain power, either through revolution or through reformist strategies, whatever, you know, however you manage to do it, your first task is to transform the character of the state itself. You can't just use it. You've got to transform it. The more extravagant language of the sort of revolutionary era was, you can't just transform it, you've got to smash it. That was a kind of classical slogan, smash the state. That's a bit excessive rhetoric. It implies more than the theory justifies. The theory, even the strong theory about the capitalist state, doesn't imply that the process by which you would transform the institutions of the state has to take the character of a wrecking ball, you know, where you destroy it, level it, and then build an alternative. That's a bit extreme. But the metaphor is still meant to suggest something fundamental, that this is not an instrument that can be used for that purpose. The very form of the state generates effects that serve the interests of capitalists. The same thing could be said about other formal properties of the state. If we have time, we'll look briefly at the argument that the state isn't just a capitalist state, it's a patriarchal state. And that if you really want gender emancipation, if you really want an emancipatory alternative to male domination, to gender inequality, you can't just use this machinery. You have to change the very character of the machinery itself in order for it to serve as an effective way of changing the rules of the game outside of the state. It just won't work. It won't be stable. It'll be ephemeral victories if you don't change the patriarchal character of the state. The arguments for the class character of the state are more developed. The arguments around the patriarchal character of the state are often arguments about the patriarchal character of the policies of the state rather than the very form of the state. And this is an issue about the form. I'm talking about the form of the state, how it is organized as an apparatus. But we'll get to that at the end. So here's then the central question. Both of these approaches observe that policies serve the interests of capitalists. But how do we explain those policies? And to what extent do we have to explain them by the actions of external actors or by the form of the state itself? Does the state act at the behest of capital or just on behalf of capital? At the behest of capital means it gets instructions, so to speak. Now, you know, the instrumentalist view doesn't have to take the form of a conspiracy theory. You know, there are some versions of instrumentalism that really require that you find a cabal of capitalists in a dark room that are actually saying, no, this is what the state should do. No, it doesn't have to be kind of a crude instrumentalism. Instrumentalism can occur through complicated forms of social networks, through the way in which policy formation processes are funded by and anchored in ruling class networks, social clubs. I mean, there's all sorts of ways in which this instrumental view of the state works out. But the key problem is that the state's policies, I'm just repeating it, are ultimately traceable to the actions of actors who are consciously serving the interests of particular groups. That's their purposes. As opposed to the nature of the apparatuses which they're using. Now, to just say something about the kind of end point of the analysis, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that both there are both instrumental and structural processes in play. Lots of policies are heavily influenced by the direct conscious actions of powerful actors who are trying to serve their interests. That's certainly true. And the apparatuses have biases built into them, which make it easier or harder for such influences to take place. The apparatuses may not be neutral, that is, they're biased, but it also doesn't follow from the fact that they're biased that they can't be used for purposes against their biases. It's just harder. The strong version of the capital state says that it can't be used at all for emancipatory purposes. A weaker version says they can be, it's just harder to do so. That you'll be constantly fighting pieces, aspects of the way the institutions are organized if you're trying to use them for emancipatory purposes, but that doesn't mean you can't use them for emancipatory purposes. It therefore may be possible to have a kind of strategic framework within which one recognizes the imperfection of this set of apparatuses for purposes of a radical, democratic, egalitarian alternative. It's not a good instrument for that purpose, but nevertheless, you can make do with it. It may be good enough under certain historical circumstances to get a process in place which then allows for a trajectory of transformation over time rather than an abrupt rupture. The typical argument from the theory of the capitalist state is that we have to have a rupture with this machine, otherwise we can't move forward. Well, you can have a non-ruptural view that still recognizes the biases of the machine. That will be one of the things, again, we'll discuss at the end of the semester. All right, so how are we going to proceed today? We have an hour. See how much of this we can get through. And in spite of the fact that we're always under time pressure, interrupt me. Don't let me just keep going on. I keep saying this, you know, show your chops by raising questions as they occur to you. Don't feel shy about it. We're going to do three things. We're going to first examine a methodological issue. What does it even mean to establish the class character of the properties of the state? How should we even think of what the task is? What does it mean to establish a bias in an institution? How to think about it? For that, we're going to look at the work of Klaus Offa, who I think has very interesting things to say about this as a methodological problem. You know, how do we gain knowledge of this sort of phenomenon? Second, we're going to discuss some of the candidates for the properties of the state which have this distinctively capitalist character. For that, we'll be looking at Joran Terborn's work, which, even if the book has some fairly archaic language at times, I think it still is the most interesting piece of work to carefully lay out this problem. And then finally, if we have time, we'll look at some of the candidates for properties of the state that might give it a distinctively patriarchal character. And again, we'll be looking at the characters of the form of the state that would render it biased in a patriarchal way, not just the policies that come out of the state. Okay, so first the methodological question. Two issues that he addresses. First, what is the meaning of saying the state has a class character? What are we really talking about when we do that? And secondly, how do we empirically demonstrate or discover these properties? So Offa does not want this just to be a philosophical discussion. He also wants it to be an empirical question. How would you do research on this? The social science stance, what it means to say this is social science, is you want to make propositions about the world around which you can gather observations which could be wrong and somebody could challenge you. You know, I think we want something more sophisticated than, you know, just the verificationist view. I think the idea is that there are disagreements about the mechanisms in the world. You need to be able to gather evidence, observations, that help to adjudicate disagreements. And adjudicate doesn't mean once and for all decisively defeat your opponent. It means to add weight to one side or another of the argument. So you have to have a way of pointing to the kind of evidence that would add credibility to your claim. And if you can't, as if you can't think of any research strategy that would enable you to make observations, then it basically remains more of a speculative claim rather than a scientific argument. And that there are very important claims in social science that theorists make, which no matter how hard you think about it, you just can't imagine, you know, even in principle, how could you possibly gather evidence that would lend support to it? All right, so first, the meaning of class character. The basic idea that Offa argues for is a notion of what he calls negative selectivity. Negative selectivity. The structure of the state is such that it makes certain state actions impossible and others improbable. That is, it systematically imposes biases into the process of policy formation. So you create a machine through which human beings are going to make policy. They are going to create rules, that is, laws that they're going to impose on the society. That's what states do. They make, enforce, defend, etc., law, rules. That's what we mean by a law. It's a rule. The process by which this is organized, the claim is, has this character of negative selectivity. It's not that it determines what happens. It determines what doesn't happen. It excludes. Negative selectivity is a principle of excluding things from the outcome, not determining exactly what happens, just what doesn't happen. And rather than think of this as binary, you know, just it excludes in a kind of rigid way things that can't happen and things that do happen, I think the better way to think of it is it may make some things impossible, but more importantly, it makes certain outcomes improbable, makes some things easy and some things difficult. The claim that the state has a class character then is a claim that these negative selections, this negative selectivity, has a class bias to it. That's a pretty bold claim. Not just that it excludes some things and includes others. It's hard to imagine any kind of apparatus that wouldn't have some kind of selectivity in it. But rather, that there's an actual content to what gets excluded. What gets excluded has a class bias to it. Policies which are, to the extent that a policy is threatening to the interests of capital, to that extent it will be negatively selected. So you can think of this as a variable. Some policies are a little irritable to capitalists. There'll be a bit of a bias against them. Some policies could really potentially damage capitalism, but not destroy capitalism. There'll be a bigger bias against those. Policies which would really go against the capital interests of capital are very hard to imagine getting through the policy formation process. And not just because the people making it don't want it to happen. It's not just because they themselves are the agents of capital. Even if they were the agents of capital, it would be hard to get those things through because of these negative selectivities. That's the claim. One can think of this as operating in all sorts of different ways. I think the simplest is the way the non-decision-making theorists talk about it, and Offa invokes Bachrach and Baratz, I believe, in his discussion. That is, it excludes certain issues from the table, the agenda-setting problem. You know, so when you're going to have a healthcare reform policy being debated, certain options are just not even discussable. Other options might be discussable but are very tough to get on the table. And then you have a range of options that are on the table. So what gets on the table is the non-decision-making issue. But you can also think about it as the range of political choices in an election. Certain kinds of parties and candidates just will never have a chance in an election. The rules of the game of elections will make it extremely implausible that certain kinds of candidates and policies will be excluded. Offie's argument about this, as he develops it, he argues there are four nested selective filter mechanisms built into the state. So there's four filter mechanisms. These each by a filter mechanism. It's excluding things. That's what filters do. You know, if you think of a sieve, you know, as a filter, a very fine sieve is going to exclude everything except tiny little grains of sand. A coarse sieve will let little pebbles through, but not rocks and so on. So these are successive filter mechanisms. He discusses. He doesn't go into, I think, a whole lot of detail in the things we've read about this. Terborne's book, which, although Terborne doesn't cite Offa, these things were being written about the same time. He's making a very similar kind of argument about negative selection. Terborne goes into a lot more detail about particular mechanisms and how they exclude. But for Offa, the four are, first, he calls structural or constitutional properties of the state, the way, for example, the public-private distinction is built into the varied decision-making process of the state, the way electoral institutions are organized, the rules of the game for elections would be another example of a structural exclusion mechanism. Second, he talks about ideological filters, what is considered legitimate or illegitimate ideologically. Third, he talks about procedural filters or process filters in the process of policy formation. The number of committees proposals have to go through, the way technical vetting of proposals has to be gone through the techno-bureaucratic structure, the way in which public hearings are held around different policies. I mean, all of these kinds of details of process also act as filters. Yeah.
How do we know those filtering mechanisms are induced by class bias?
So that's the next problem. That's 2.2. How do we demonstrate that this actually has a class bias? So turns out to be a big difficulty. And finally, there's repression. You know, if all else fails, you can have repressive exclusions. That seems like it seems a little bit of, as a last gasp effort. If all of these other things had failed, it's not so obvious why, if they're all failing, why the repressive mechanisms wouldn't themselves also have failed to have a class bias in them. But nevertheless, he sees repression as the end of the last filtering mechanism if the other filters have not adequately excluded policies with the necessary class character. But then how to demonstrate it? How do you explain what doesn't happen, things that are excluded? So we observe that really anti-capitalist policies don't get enacted. But how do we justify that they just haven't gotten enacted because they don't have popular support, as opposed to they haven't gotten enacted because there's all these filter mechanisms in place? I mean, I had a nice experience when I first came to Wisconsin. This was in 1976. So the students, when I got recruited, and I was basically recruited by graduate students. I mean, they were the people I had prior connections to. I think I told you this story a little bit at the beginning of the semester. And they lobbied for me to get hired, and that's how it happened, basically. I mean, I might have gotten hired anyway. I'm not saying that the faculty just caved into student pressure. But there was a group of grad students who I had prior contact and connections to. Well, they were all gung-ho about creating a Marxist program in the department. And it was a very high point of Marxist theorizing. There were lots of Marxist-oriented graduate students in the department, and they wanted a program in Marxist sociology. And they thought this would be just this huge battle. They thought that the bourgeois character of the university and the department would have negative selection. They had all read Offa, and you know, they were all into this, as was I. They thought that clearly they would have to mobilize strongly and fight the department to get a program in Marxist sociology going. So we developed a proposal, we developed a curriculum. This course, which was then a two-semester required course for anybody who was in the Marxist program, they'd have to take. And we made the proposal to the faculty at a department meeting, and they said, sure. So that's an example of something which wasn't excluded, just some things that haven't happened, just haven't happened yet. But there's no exclusion process, it's just that they haven't been demanded yet, for whatever reason. Now, that could be because people thought it was impossible, and the very thinking of it being impossible might render things impossible, because you don't bother pushing for things that you think are impossible. That's possible as well. That's one of the motivations behind my Real Utopias project, is the idea that the limits of what's possible depends in part upon what people believe is possible. That's this peculiar feature of limits of possibility of the human world, is that unlike the speed of light, in which the limit at which things can move is independent of our theories of how fast things can move. Before Einstein came up with the theory of relativity, it was still the case that the speed of light was the fastest anything can go. And it still is. The theory doesn't explain anything about the actual limits. Our beliefs in the theory doesn't explain anything. But that isn't true about social phenomena. Our beliefs in what's possible is one of the determinants of what's possible. That's kind of obvious when you say it. Of course it's true. Now, it doesn't mean that any belief of what's possible therefore renders it possible. You know, religion specializes in beliefs and possibility that don't render the things believed possible. We fully understand why people believe in eternal life and life after death. You know, whether or not it's true is another matter, but it's easy to understand psychologically why people believe in it. The belief in it doesn't render it true. You know, the limits of possibility for human organisms and the consciousness sustained by human brains, that depends upon the laws of nature and how it works. And changing your beliefs about that isn't going to change the limits of possibility. But changing your beliefs about what institutional alternatives there are surely affects what's possible, since what's possible depends upon the collective actions of people to achieve things, and their collective action depends upon their beliefs in part. All right, well, that's a long-winded way of saying that it's easy to be mistaken that things are being excluded by the very nature of the institutions in which you're operating. Be mistaken about that. They're not being excluded. They just haven't been effectively fought for yet. And that's why this is a methodological problem. Some things are what Offey would describe as contingently excluded. Some events, non-events, are just potential events that haven't yet happened. That's the example of the Marxist sociology program in the department, which we decided to call class analysis and historical change rather than program in Marxist sociology, because we were a bit nervous about surveillance from, you know, state authorities, not so much from the university, but from external actors. And if we had labeled it Marxist, it might render it more vulnerable. I think in the end it was actually a good decision, even if it reflected a certain, you know, political uneasiness, because it rendered it a more open platform, arena. And the term Marxist would suggest that the program had a more closed character to it than just class analysis and historical change, which signals to any graduate student who is interested in Marxism that this would be a happy home, but doesn't signal to students who aren't directly committed to a Marxist framework or tradition, doesn't signal to them that they're not welcome. It says this is the agenda, it's class analysis and historical change. Okay, well, that's just contingently excluded. Some non-events are what Offey, I think, calls epically excluded. They're excluded because there's no social category that could conceivably support them. So the practice of the sacrifice of animals by the state at harvest time. If we want to ask, well, why doesn't the state of Wisconsin at harvest time have a sacrifice of goats on the state capitol steps? you know, this is being systematically excluded by the biases of the institution. Well, give me a break. I mean, there just is no constituency of persons for whom that is a policy which they would like to see. But not because they are just unenlightened and don't understand what's in their interests, not because of some mechanism at work, it's just, it's epically excluded. We're not in the kind of world in which that kind of demand would ever have a constituency. It's an uninteresting argument. I mean, you can't imagine somebody writing an interesting paper. I mean, this is a challenge. Can you write an interesting paper on the question, why doesn't the state of Wisconsin have an annual harvest time sacrifice of goats on the state capitol steps? I mean, the only reason it would be an interesting paper would be because of it being so outrageous, the question being so outrageous, that it might provoke some interesting points about epical possibilities. So what he says is, okay, let's ignore the contingently excluded, things that just haven't happened yet, and the epically excluded, things that couldn't conceivably happen because there's absolutely no plausible account for why anybody would want them to happen. Let's look at the things that are systematically excluded. And he proposes basically five strategies for identifying systematically excluded possibilities. None of them are perfect. All of them have problems. But all of them also have attractions. So they all, you know, they all give you a little bit of a piece of the action. He doesn't come up with a solution that is fully satisfactory. So these are, again, are just pieces of a kind of methodological menu that you can use to add weight to an argument. So the first is you can have normative criteria. You can say, well, these normatively valuable options are never discussed, they're never on the table. And that would be a way of identifying things that don't happen that are of value. You've provided a criterion for why they are of value. And it would add some credibility to the claim. If these valuable things are never discussed, well, there's a puzzle for why. And the idea that there's something systematic about the machinery that excludes them then gains some credibility. The problem, of course, is that normative criteria potentially suffer from arbitrariness. They can shade into the epical exclusion. You can argue about objective interests. You can say, well, these things which would be objectively in the interests of workers are not included on the agenda of the state. They're excluded from state policy formation. But of course, the idea of objective interests is always difficult to specify. I think Offey overstates the difficulty of having a good account of objective interests, but still, it's a problem. That becomes a contested arena. Somebody says, well, this is objectively in the interest of workers, and it's not discussed. And somebody will say, no, that's not in the objective interest of workers. That's just stupid. You know, that's just, you're not realizing all the complications. A third, this is getting now to more tractable empirical strategies. There's the possibility of empirical comparisons. You can look at places where something is on the agenda and where something isn't on the agenda. Variations across states, across time. And then by examining the nature of the apparatuses where things get on the agenda from where they don't, you may be able to identify exclusion mechanisms. There's a very well-known book of the 70s. I continue to see it every once in a while cited, so I think it's still active in the literature. It's called The Unpolitics of Air Pollution. The Unpolitics of Air Pollution. And by Matthew Cranson. It's a good book, very good book. It's an empirical comparison of a number of cities in the United States to see the extent to which they, in the era prior to the Environmental Protection Agency imposing clean air standards across states, so it became a federalized issue, some cities had air pollution rules and some didn't. The question is why? How do you explain the variation across cities? And there were some cities with a lot of pollution in which it was never even discussed in the city council. It never got onto the agenda. Now that's a kind of puzzle. You got a city with a lot of pollution. I think it was water pollution too, not just air pollution. I mean, I forget the details. He made the argument using the kind of non-decision making, kind of non-event, negative selection argument, that there were mechanisms that kept the issue off the table, and the central mechanism was the dependence of city government on taxes from the major polluters. That there were big polluters, well known, that the state's dependence, the city's dependence on resources from those sectors of the economy made it off limits to talk about. And it wasn't because the capitalists and the owners of those sectors lobbied. So it wasn't instrumental. It wasn't because they lobbied. They didn't need to lobby. It was because of the tax dependency of the state, of the municipality. Well, that's a pretty persuasive argument, and it does have to do with the form of the city. If the city's tax revenues came mainly from a redistribution from state-level revenues, you know, there are places in the world where city government's revenues are not highly dependent upon local taxes. They're dependent upon some redistributive mechanism where they get block grants from higher levels of government. Well, one might expect that in such context there would be greater willingness for city governments to tackle problems that were generated by local economic actors. But Offey raises the objection to that strategy, this straight empirical comparison strategy, on the grounds that it is really unable to tackle the problem of exclusions that are common to all cases. Right, so there'll be exclusions of around the support of capitalist interests that are common to all cities, irrespective of the degree of air pollution. But that seems to me just a modest criticism, that you can get at some exclusionary mechanism, some negative selectivity, but not all, is a virtue of comparative work. I think comparative work is really at the heart of how you deal with this. If you want to show something's negatively selected, you have to find cases where it isn't. And you compare and see if you can identify features of the apparatus that are doing this exclusion. If you can make a good case, you've added evidence to the claim. The fourth strategy is voiced claims. That is one way you can see what's excluded. Let me just finish this sentence. One way you can see what's excluded is you see people demanding certain kinds of things which never get translated onto the table. So there's something which is obstructing the translation of voiced demands into considered alternatives. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to see if I could pinpoint an actual example of an empirical comparison which was in this structure itself, the electoral system of the U.S. compared to the electoral system of Denmark.
Sure.
Here it is. It's practically a two-party system, and Denmark has 9.
Right.
And ranging from pretty radical leftists to pretty radical right-wing parties,
right,
which I guess has something to do with the system.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So one could absolutely say that different rules of the game of elections allow different political voices to be registered, to be heard in the public debate. Then there's the additional question then of what is it that excludes the most radical leftist voices from actually getting translated into the agenda of public policy, because the most left-wing parties are not part of coalition. They, you know, they don't enter government. The near left, I mean, the if you have 9, it would be from 8 to 2 that are viable for different coalition partners. Sometimes, of course, the most left might, if it's moderate enough, but a really anti-capitalist party that was kind of advocating the overthrow of capitalism is unlikely to ever become part of the actual agenda setting. And so you'd still face the problems. Well, why is that the case? What's the bias? And the one answer is because it doesn't have enough support.
Wouldn't that be an additional bias?
Yeah.
So there would still be like the winner takes it all system will will favor middle, like
right,
consensus
absolutely.
Parties. Where, but,
right.
but then even if when the leftist parties gets into parliament, then
some other mechanisms
yeah.
come into play. Absolutely.
Okay.
So the left in the United States has always, one of its demands has always been, we got to change the rules of the game of the electoral system. We have to make it easier for coherent left voices to have political representation. The assumption has been as if they have political representation, they can actually have more political impact, and that may or may not be true. You know, may or may not be true. They could have political representation and be completely marginalized within the legislature and have absolutely no capacity to affect the agenda. And that certainly has happened in many European cases where the most extreme or radical parties get marginalized in the policy formation process, even if they are not as marginalized in the political universe as a whole. But that you're right, that implies that there's additional mechanisms in play to ensure that marginalization once they get elected. We'll discuss, some of these issues are actually going to come up next week when we discuss the dilemmas of electoral politics, so that'll be a place where we can explore some of these issues. Finally, fifth, and this is where Offa thinks really you can get some traction. The limits of possibility created by negative selections are observable, or most observable, under those special historical circumstances in which they are transformed and challenged. That is, there are crisis moments where the exclusionary processes begin to break down. And in a crisis moment is where you can see actually those mechanisms become rendered visible when they're in the process of disintegration. Crisis is the empirical setting for studying the normal functioning of the system. That's an interesting proposition. It's a bit like the way psychoanalysis treats psychopathology as a way of getting insight into the ordinary functioning of the human mind, the human psyche. You know, that was Freud's kind of great insight, whether or not you're a Freudian and believe that his mechanisms are adequate. But the insight was that pathology helps you understand normal functioning, whereas just studying normal functioning by itself doesn't tell you as much. It's when the normal functioning, those normal mechanisms break down, that you see how they worked when they were working well. You see what it is that broke down enables you to understand what was in place beforehand. When they're all working well, they're less visible. There's a lot more to say about these methodological issues, but let's turn now to Terborn's. Yeah.
So I guess one thing I was thinking about is situations where the rules are set up, like say the American case where a lot of the rules were set up to exclude African Americans, but it might have had the effect of also excluding class interests. So how would he go about proposing that you can like deconstruct the different forms of domination that are written into the rules and like really isolating the class issue?
So examples would, it's certainly true that there were rules set up around African Americans that also had as an effect excluding certain class processes. But sometimes that was not actually separate. It was actually part of the purpose for the racial exclusions. So an example is in the New Deal, the exclusions from the Labor Relations Acts that had specific racial effects in the South, because Southerners demanded it, were actually being demanded because of the class effects of that, the racial barriers created. It was about excluding sharecroppers and the kinds of exploitative situations in which African Americans were segregated into in the South. So the racial mechanisms were there in part because they were also class mechanisms. You know, as opposed to there being something we could call a racial mechanism and something we could call a class mechanism. It really was because of the tight connection in the South between race and class that you could kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. I suppose that the way you would approach this is you could find those occasions where the class mechanism, the class context for exclusion changed, and the racial context remained the same, and see what happens. So David James's dissertation, which I briefly mentioned in our discussion of race and class, about the connection between the Jim Crow laws, which were a specific set of deeply institutionalized racial exclusions in the southern state, essentially the apartheid state in the South. His argument was that these were deeply connected to sharecropping, and that the reason for the explanation for the strength of those racial exclusion rules was in order to reproduce sharecropping, not just to reproduce racial domination for its own sake. Then what he argued is, if this is true, if that's the right explanation for the setting up of segregation laws, then it should be the case that once sharecropping disappears, that those racial exclusions should be way more visible and transformable and vulnerable. That is, they should be revealed as racial exclusions without a foundation and transformable. And furthermore, and here is, I think, the most interesting part of his argument, in those parts of the South where historically the racial exclusions were most deeply connected to sharecropping, that's where you should see the resistance to the civil rights movement in the 60s. Mm-hmm. So if you want to, and I thought that was a really clever way of getting evidence that supports the original claim, that it was sharecropping that explains apartheid rather than apartheid that explains sharecropping. It's not racism that explains hyper-exploitation of sharecroppers. It's the need for hyper-exploitation of sharecroppers that explains the institutionalization of racism in the state in this particularly brutal way. And indeed, that's what he observes, that the resistance to the civil rights movement in the 1960s across the South was most intense in those counties which historically had the deepest sharecropping. So that's the kind of way you'd, that's the sort of unusual historical context where you might be able to parse the difference between the racial exclusion mechanisms that are there for their own sake and the ones that are there by virtue of their connection to class exclusions. Yeah?
So, like, I have one, is it logical, if you could call it critique, if office objective is to demonstrate that what state does not do is a reflection of its class character, then why do we focus on the excluded options that are not on the table to demonstrate it? Why don't we focus on what the state actually does?
Because you have to demonstrate that what it does is the result of an exclusion. Because there's other explanations for why it does what it does, other than that it does what it does because other things have been excluded. You have to show that there's a bias in the process by what it does occurring, that there's a biased process that's generating it. Because it could be the result of a process that isn't biased. You could still get the state only serving certain interests, even if the mechanisms of the state weren't biased. It could be because those are the social forces that have organized for particular purposes. Could be for instrumental reasons, not apparatus reasons.
Like assault on unions in the past 4 decades, for instance, by the state.
Yeah, so that's been pushed by pro-capitalist interests. So nobody denies that the state does things in the interest of capital. The question is whether it does so by virtue of its form. That's the difficult thing. So the state attacks unions. The Koch brothers are in favor of attacking unions. The Koch brothers fund the Republican Party. The Heritage Foundation says unions are an impediment to efficient markets. You have all these institutions of the ruling class opposing unions and funding politics, and then you get anti-union policies. So one account is this is just the result of a successful campaign by ruling class interests to use the state to accomplish their purposes. But it has nothing to do with any biases in the state itself. That's the state and capitalist society. It's precisely because you're trying to distinguish pro-capitalist outcomes that occur for instrumental reasons from the extent to which that's also being generated by the very properties of the state that this whole debate occurs. The reason it matters politically is if you depending upon your view on these things, it does affect the political agenda of the left. The left sees that it really has to struggle over the character of the state itself. That means that if on the occasions when it gets in power, that has to be part of its agenda. Now, before the universal franchise, everybody knew the state was biased, right? When you had a property franchise, you had to own property in order to vote. So what's the first demand of progressives at that time? The very first demand is universal franchise. Now, that's a change in the form of the state. Universal franchise isn't a policy. It's a change in the character of the state. How are political officials recruited? What's the formal mechanisms through which recruitment of decision makers occurs? Under a property franchise, it's people with property choose the decision makers. Under a universal franchise, it's the masses choose the. Before the universal franchise, virtually everybody thought that if you had universal franchise, this was going to be a Pandora's box. It would really create a problem. Marx certainly thought universal franchise is a recipe for destabilization of capitalism because you're empowering those parts of the population to choose the decision makers. You're empowering that part of the population which is most oppressed in the society. What could be a better recipe for destabilizing the exclusionary mechanisms of the state? So both conservatives and leftists thought that would be destabilizing. This is the puzzle we're going to discuss next week when we look at Adam Szaworski's work about why universal franchise didn't ultimately destabilize capitalism, which is, you know, quite a remarkable thing. Before it happened, everybody thought it would destabilize capitalism. In the case of slavery, you can imagine you couldn't have universal franchise. You know, it's completely implausible that if you had universal franchise in the South before the Civil War, if the black slaves had the vote, that this wouldn't destabilize slavery. You know, it's just not plausible that slavery could have remained. And indeed, Jim Crow sharecropping, that's why the black population was denied the right to vote in the South. The reimposition of the next best thing to slavery, repressive forms of slavery, of sharecropping, required the disenfranchisement of the black population. So it is true that universal franchise does destabilize certain kinds of class relations. It just turns out, contrary to the expectation, that it didn't really destabilize capitalism. And that's an interesting historical phenomenon. You know, it's a case where everybody thought it would, and it didn't. But that's the general form of the argument that applies to other properties of the state. Can you have centralized bureaucracies with Weberian-type top-down command structures? Can you have all this kind of machinery of the state that we are familiar with and have it be used for radical emancipatory purposes? So that's why you have to look at what's excluded. That's the whole game is there. Okay? Yeah?
So I just have a question on this fifth point of crisis and failure. So for example, when he uses this like strategy of looking at crisis, does he mean the idea of political crisis, like crisis of the state?
Yeah,
or
yeah.
I
think he's mainly talking about crises of the state. It's where the state machinery is breaking down. I mean, I didn't reread the essay for the lecture today to refresh my memory as to exactly what he talks about. I believe he's really talking about political crisis.
And could it also be the case, with the same reasoning, to look at economic crisis, for example, in the assumption that economic crisis could also destabilize the state?
It's possible that the combination of the two would be a particularly good setting. The issue is how do you observe the negative selections in the state itself, though? That's the problem you're trying to solve. So if you had an economic crisis in which the state was just functioning just fine and responding to the economic crisis without any internal political machinery crisis, crisis in what and how the state works, then it might not then reveal these exclusionary mechanisms as well. So I think it really probably does have to be more of a crisis of the state that's in play. Well, let's now shift gears to Terreborn's. What does the ruling class do when it rules? So Terreborn embraces the same kind of idea. His approach is basically a combination of an historical comparative analysis with some sort of what I would describe as theoretical speculative analysis. So his basic strategy to demonstrate that the capitalist state is indeed a capitalist state is to, on the one hand, compare it to the feudal state and to say, what are the mechanisms in the feudal state in contrast to the capitalist state that seem in the very structure of these two kinds of states to ensure that on the one hand the feudal state reproduces feudalism and on the other hand the capitalist state reproduces capitalism. But he also then, and this is more problematic, says, well, that's not a good enough comparison. We also need to compare the capitalist state with the socialist state. And he proposes that we can do this empirically by looking at the properties of the state apparatuses of the centrally command economy states that went under the name of socialism, particularly in the Soviet Union. That was his primary empirical context. Secondarily, I think some, you know, informed by Eastern Europe. This is 1978, I think, when he wrote the book. Probably to a lesser extent, China. The idea was that these are historical examples of the attempts at building a state modeled after the ideas of the Marxist tradition. As I said last time, Terreborn indeed uses the expression dictatorship of the proletariat to describe the form of these states in one part of the book. However archaic that sounds, it should not be. You should try to deafen your linguistic ears and have it mean not the dictatorship, but you know the radically democratic rule of the working class would be the proper term of the expression dictatorship of the proletariat, but so be it. And he proposes this three-way comparison. The heart of the book is around the heart of his discussion of the class character of the state is around this three-way comparison of the capitalist state, the feudal state, and the socialist state. Now, this, of course, depends upon the belief that the states which went under the name of socialism were indeed prototypes, however imperfect, of the capitalist of the socialist state. Terreborn doesn't deny the fact that these were authoritarian states, one-party rules under authoritarian conditions, but he points out that just as Marxists typically are perfectly happy to say that the capitalist state can take democratic or authoritarian forms. Franco-Spain in the 1970s was a capitalist state, just as democratic France was. So the form of regime, whether it's authoritarian or democratic, is a separate issue from the form of the state, which has to do with its deeper organizational principles. I'm pretty skeptical of that move myself. I think that the very character of the idea of a socialist economy and its relationship to the state, the idea of democracy looms larger than just the form of regime. Because if what we mean by socialism is that the working class or the working people or the masses, you know, you take your pick, it's not so important for this purpose, democratically controls the fundamental organization of the economy to serve its interests, then the idea that the state could be undemocratic is itself a violation of the very constitutive principle of what would render the economy socialist in the first place. You know, so since the idea of democracy is at the core of what socialism means as an economic structure, it's hard to reconcile that with a authoritarian state apparatus when the state is deeply involved in organizing the economy. that's why in my work on this, I refer to the Soviet Union as authoritarian statism rather than an authoritarian socialism. And the basic story was that there was a revolutionary attempt at building socialism under historical conditions in which the trajectory of state building that occurred in that context produced a different kind of both state and economy. Did not produce a socialist economy, it produced a statist economy, an economy that was organized by the state, not democratically subordinated to the either the working class understood narrowly or the people understood broadly. But Terborn nevertheless tries to use the Soviet Union as a foil for elaborating these contrasts. And from the point of view of the exposition of his argument, it still serves that purpose. It requires him to do a kind of soft reading of the Soviet Union, you know, not to look so much at its actual practices with respect to its state institutions and look more at its self-description of its practices. So I think the way to think about it is that he has a theoretical argument for the socialist-capitalist comparison and an empirical argument for the capitalist-feudal comparison. And that's okay. I mean, that seems to me fine as a strategy. The heart of the analysis is builds around a distinction between state apparatus and state power. State apparatus and state power. Let's see, we're now on the 3.1, state apparatus and state power. The state apparatus is the institutional structure through which state power is exercised. It's the machinery of the state. It's the organizational means of production of politics. What is state power? Now, this is more complex. Terborn's account of state power in places is even obscure. And I don't want to spend as much time on it because it gets us into a murkier discussion. But basically, I think the idea is that state power refers to the capacity of the state to produce effects in the world. That's bringing it into alignment with my general use of the word power, which is the capacity to produce effects. This is the capacity to produce effects of this particular machinery, the apparatus. The apparatus is used by human beings. It's not that the state apparatus itself does anything. The apparatus is used by people to generate effects. The capacity to generate those effects is state power. Terborn's central thesis, like Offa's, is that these apparatuses have a distinctive class character. I think he adopts what I would call a weak version of the thesis. The strong version of the thesis would be this. So here there's two versions of the claim that it has a class character. The strong version is these apparatuses are structured in such a way as to ensure the production of effects which reproduce capitalism and the class power of capitalists. Ensure. These state apparatuses are designed to guarantee the reproduction of capitalism and the power of capitalists and the interests of capital. The weak version is that they exclude radically non-reproductive or disruptive effects. I think Terborn pretty much buys into the weak version because he does entertain in an interesting part of the discussion. I'm not sure if this was assigned. I don't remember exactly which pages I assigned for the class. But he does entertain the possibility that even with all these well-designed class exclusions in the state, that quite disruptive and dysfunctional effects can still be produced by the state. And we'll be looking at that problem, the contradictory functionality of the state, next Wednesday. I think that's the second of the two sessions next week. Well, let's cut to the chase and look at some of Terborn's substantive claims. And we're going to obviously run out of time. We're at 3.2. I'll be So we're going to be having a series of lectures which will have perpetually this problem, that we'll do the tail end of one lecture at the beginning of the following one, and then the semester will come to an end and we'll be done. And so the last half lecture will not get done, I guess, at some point. Well, let's just try to begin this. Okay, so he is pretty systematic in this attempt. He says, okay, the state's an organization. That's what it is. It's these apparatuses, it's an organization. He identifies 11 aspects of organizations that all states, these are 11 features that all states have just by virtue of being organizations. They're grouped into, roughly speaking, there's inputs into the organizations. You have inputs of resources, you have recruitment of people, there's all sorts of these inputs. Then there's internal processes by which these inputs are used. That's the machinery of the state to actually produce policies. And then you have the outputs of the state, the things that states do. Inputs, processes, and outputs. And he typologizes these. And then he asks, for each of these elements, can we identify a distinctive class character? So let's just look at some of them, some of these things. A key aspect of the inputs of the state is a selection of what the state does. What are the tasks of the state? Of all the possible things the state does, which ones are the sorts of things states do and which are the sorts of things states don't do? He refers to this as the selection of tasks. Now here, the key distinction is between the public and private spheres, which is institutionalized into constitutions, legal procedures, specifications of rights, all sorts of ways in which a boundary between a public sphere, which is fair game for the state to do things, tasks can be drawn from the public sphere, and a private sphere, which the state is not supposed to touch. If you have a really depoliticized private sphere, it's in principle non-contestable. It really is something that's outside of the bounds of legitimate state involvement. The institutionalization of a depoliticized private sphere, which is non-contestable, is essential for the reproduction of capitalist interests because it insulates them from possible assault by the working class. Well, this leads to then contrast between feudalism, capitalism, and socialism in terms of how the public-private boundary is drawn. What are the constitutional principles by which that distinction is made? In feudalism, the public is absorbed into the private. It's the private affairs of the king, which is the public response, you know, the public tasks of the king. In capitalism, the two are institutionally distinct, although the boundary may shift over time, where private property is the pivotal content of drawing the line of demarcation between public and private. And in socialism, the private is subordinated to the public. The private is subordinated to the public. It's open to public debate aspects of private life, which then through public debate it gets decided what aspects the state should be involved in and what aspects it should not. A couple of comments, and I guess that will bring us to an end. So we'll just finish this first task. The line of demarcation between the public and private has been called into question in advanced capitalism. You know, that is, there were lines of demarcation between public and private in 19th century capitalism that are transgressed, including around private property, which are transgressed. This means that there's much more complexity to the maintenance of that boundary under advanced capitalist conditions. The interventions of the state into working conditions on the shop floor within production is a penetration of the state across the public-private boundary as that boundary was understood in the past. And that makes the boundary more precarious under conditions of advanced capitalism than it was under conditions of earlier capitalism. It's one of the reasons why the right wing wants to constantly roll back that boundary. It's not because they don't think it's a good thing to have unsafe conditions on the workplace, or even that they believe capitalists will take care of it. It's just that the violation of the boundary calls into question other aspects of that boundary. And they believe it's a slippery slope. And they believe it with good reason. Because it is a slippery slope. Once you violate the boundary, then where do you stop? A second issue. This is a particular aspect of the state which also very strongly bears on feminist concerns and is one of the candidates for what renders the state a patriarchal state. The issue of the family as a private sphere insulated from state intervention. That was a part of patriarchy. One of the things that helped reproduce patriarchy was the hands-off view of the state. It was a major breakthrough, for example, when rape within marriage was defined as rape and a criminal offense. To define rape within marriage as a criminal offense means that the family is an appropriate site of intervention of state power. To then say that physical punishment of children is child abuse and that the state has the right to intervene in the family around child abuse is a further penetration of the public into the private, breaking down the boundary between. Now this raises some very complicated issues because on the other hand, for feminists, the idea of the body as a private sphere is really important. So the feminism has this character of wanting to break the boundary at the level of the family. They do want the state to intervene in the family, to block male domination in the household of the most egregious forms, and child, the rights of children. But they want to draw the boundary at the body. That's what reproductive rights is all about. The state is not allowed to interfere in the control over my own fertility, my own reproductive system. And that's, I'm not saying that's unreasonable, but it shows the complexity around the public-private boundary and around its relationship to sexuality as well. So, but that's an example. The public-private boundary is not really a policy. When the state decides that, yes, rape within a marriage is rape, that's not just a new policy. That's a fundamental change of the constitutional standing of the family as outside of the domain of the state. And that's changing the very form of the state by which subsequent policy making can take place over all sorts of policies that would regulate life within the family. Okay, we've done selection of tasks. We'll continue down through this list on Monday. Yeah. See you then.